You know how a lot of people really like salted caramel? That sweet, rich caramel flavor, that bite of the salt, and come on, if you like it, you know you like it with a little extra salt, don't you? Of course you do. And that's why you listen to The Ron Van Dam Show. He is the sweet and salty treat of the podcasting world, with a little extra saltiness. It's an acquired taste. You're listening to The Ron Van Dam Show on New England Broadcasting.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's The Ron Van Dam Show.
Okay, all right.
Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
God, get off my back. Constantly bothering me to do a show. Seriously, I don't bother you. Welcome to the program. It is the Ron Van Dam Show. Yes, it is. It's Friday. Oh, aren't you excited? There's a weekend coming. Ooh. Aren't you excited about that? No, I'm not either. Ooh, the weekend's coming. You're getting out of work jail. What's work jail? Well, it's like going to jail where you have to go and you're not released until later in the day and you have to be there. And if not, then you're in trouble. Work jail! Only thing worse than work jail? Jury duty. Ooh, you're really, really depressing me now. I'm just gonna moan for 30 minutes if you don't mind. It's therapy for me. I don't know what you're going through, but for me it's good. All right. Let me tell you about some of the people that make this show possible before I go any further. Announcer John Shanahan, comedy writer, Hypnagogue Podcast. You can find a link to that on our New England Broadcasting website. John Shanahan, ladies and gentlemen. Ooh, man. Jason Shaw composes, performs our opening and closing theme and some incidental music, incidentally. Jason, thank you, baby. Not that he's a baby. He's a lot older than that. It's a thing you call people when you like them. You say, hi, baby. Or if there's a little baby in a crib, you can walk up to the little baby in the crib and go, hey, baby. How you doing, baby? Yeah, same thing. A little perverted, a little odd, but I mean, basically, you are correct. Hey, baby, what you doing? Hey, baby, what you doing? You playing with that little stuffed animal, baby? Huh? Hey, you threw up all over your crib, baby. Oh, baby. Oh, baby now. Ooh. Ooh. Can't you keep it inside your diaper, baby? Oh, baby. And then there's Nicole Reed, who books many of the national interviews on the program. She's a British voice that you hear at the beginning of the show. And those are just some of the people that make this show possible. Every once in a while, I stop by and talk a little bit. Beyond that, nothing going on. Thank you. I have an interesting guest coming up later in the programo. Ooh, I threw a little bit of a Latin kind of accent kind of thing. I took the word program. Watch this. I took the word program and I put an O at the end of it. And that made it kind of like, whoa, that was weird, huh? That was like another language. I don't know which one it was, but Ron certainly has a grasp of foreign languages. He took the word program, put an O at the end and said, programo. Whoa. Hold on, mister. You really can speak many languages, can't you? You bet I can. I put an O at the end of things, and I am on my way to an international flavor. Try that sometime when you want to impress somebody. Just take the English word and just throw something at the end of it and they'll go crazy about it. Yeah. Yeah, they will. Hey, you want to go to the restaurante? Restaurante? Is that some kind of European a word for restaurant? Well, yeah, I guess you speak the language too. Yep, I said restaurante. Ooh, it must be a classy, expensive place. Well, it is when I put that little ending on the word. You bet it is. Hey, you want to go out to lunch? Whoa, where are you going to take me? To a restaurant where they have a McRibbay. McRibbay. I've heard of the McRib. What is a McRibbay? Well, that is a special twist on the McRib. It's a French McRib. Why, you're really, you know your cuisines, man. That's right. That's right. And I talk really sexy to infants. Hey, baby. Hey, what you doing, baby? Hey, what you doing there, baby? Come closer to daddy. You know, I am your daddy. I mean, I really am your daddy, baby. This is getting weird. Just stop it now. Just stop it. I'm going to complain about something today. Oh, that's different. Every once in a while, I'll walk into a bar and have a cocktail or something. And every time I walk into a bar, I get the same feeling. Like, what the hell's going on? How stupid can people be? Every single bar, whether it's a sports bar or not, has TVs all over the place. All of a sudden, all the drinking establishment, you can't have a drinking establishment without at least 20 TVs. Let's open up a bar and we'll serve alcohol. What about 20 TVs? Why? What about it? You can't open up without 20 TVs. That's what the Americans are used to. They can't drink or eat anything without 20 TVs around them. But here's the problem. As much of that is a problem. That is an awful problem. But here's the real problem. On all those 20 TVs in every single bar, sports. Now, I'm not really excited by sports, and I don't think everybody is. But somehow it seems to be a rule, I think it's in the Constitution, that you have to have TVs with sports things on them all the time, no matter where you are, no matter what place you're in. Why? And here's the stupid part about these sports bars. And listen carefully, if you own a sports bar, or you manage one, listen carefully to me, because I mean, I'm serious here. It's one thing if there's a game on. I guess that's engaging, and you don't need the sound. See, in a sports bar or in any kind of bar, the sound on the TV is never on, because that's just too much. That's just invading somebody's head. A picture on a TV, or all the 20 TVs, you know, you look up or you don't. If there's a game on, okay, that's a form of entertainment. I get that. But on most of the TVs, most of the time, it's two or three sports guys talking about sports with no reference to what they're talking about. And while you're drinking, I have to be surrounded by sports guys moving their mouths and having conversation. I don't know what they're talking about, nor could I ever care. But why is that on the TV? If it's not a game in progress, an actual sports game to watch, why do you even have that on the screen? Why is that on a TV? That, to me, is incredibly annoying. It is stupid. And every time I look up when I'm having my little cocktail or something and I'm seeing two or three guys just talking and I can't hear what they're saying, I don't want to hear what they're saying, I say to myself, the hell's going on here? Why do you have that on? Why do you have that on the TV? Here's what you should have. That's what you shouldn't have. And that's what every sports bar has. And by the way, the two or three guys that are talking sports are dressed like pimps from the 1960s. And the pimps didn't even really show up until the 1970s. That's how bad it is. Why do people in sports, when they're talking about sports, have to dress like they don't know how to dress? Why are sports people such horrible dressers? Still wearing gold chains around their necks. With checkered jackets and striped shirts. What are you doing? Is it a pimp parade? What the hell's going on? Why are you dressing like that? Look around. Nobody else is dressed like you at all, ever. Not one person in the sports bar is dressed like the people on the TV talking about sports. You look like a bunch of morons on the screen. So why do these sports bars, well, it's got to be sports. You're not even a sports bar. What is that? Why does it have to be sports? I walked into this one place. I don't go there frequently because the restaurant basically sucks, but it's you know, you get a pizza there and, you know, sandwiches and stuff. And they have the 20 or 30 TVs, but they don't have sports on the TVs. They have game shows. Game shows. Now, you should be able to hear them as well, but you can't do that in the bar. You can't put the sound on. But it's more engaging, especially the trivia shows where they show the trivia question on the screen. That's more engaging for everybody. If a bar wanted to gather people, what they should do is put trivia questions on the screen, and then about 10, 15 seconds later, you give the answers. That would be engaging to each and every person in the bar. What a wonderful way to pick up somebody at a bar. You know, try to answer the questions together, you know, and they're on the screen, that kind of, you know, that's how people can actually have conversation and actually have a good time. Not watch two or three guys on a TV and you don't know what they're talking about. And it looks like they're having a good time, but they're really not. Because nobody is. That's my diatribe about sports bars and every bar now. Why is every bar that I walk into have to be a sports bar? Why? Can't you put something else on that TV? Please? Thank you. I can watch sports in my house if I want to. I don't have to go to a bar and watch it. Put something else on the screen of some interest that doesn't require sound. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When I come back, my guest is going to join us. Seriously? Yeah, I'm not kidding. It's coming up right after this.
Give the gift that says, I love you. The gift that says, happy birthday. The gift that says, get well soon. The gift that says, you're the reason I went into the priesthood. The gift that says, congratulations on not getting indicted. The gift that says, I want to cover you in warm chocolate pudding. The gift that says, good luck in clown college. The gift that says, thanks for removing my unsightly wart. The gift that says, sorry about giving you food poisoning. The gift that says, I'll see you in hell. The gift that says, remember the good times we had in prison. The gift that says, I want to make sweet love to you on the white sand beaches of Rio while your hot cousin watches. The gift that says, thank you for the kidney. The gift that says, you deserve all the best, but this will have to do. The gift that says, thanks, Jesus. Whatever you want to say, you can say it beautifully with a timeless gift from Phyllis Gorman's House of Macaroni Art on Route 94 just past the Rotary, across from Sweaty Palmer's Adult Emporium.
Sydney Lee joins us now. He's a fascinating individual. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you, Ron.
What part of the country are you in at this time?
Well, right at this moment, I'm deep in the woods using the neighboring Indian reservation's cell tower.
Oh,
I'm in the state of Maine. and about an hour back of Lumber Road to our little camp. But I normally live in Vermont, right on the New Hampshire border, the easternmost part of the state.
So you're a New England kind of guy.
Yeah, I have been all my adult life. Wonderful. I wasn't raised here, but...
Wonderful. Well, you know, a lot of people think that Maine, Vermont, that region of the country, that's a very honest nature, backwoods kind of down-to-it place to live. Is that true?
Well, yes, although, you know, America is such a fluid society, and New England's demography is changing quite rapidly. I think that, you know, for example, the state government, the representatives and state senators in Vermont now are about 50% from away, as they say here.
Yeah, that's the way that seems to work all of a sudden. You are known for your poetry and your writings, no question about that. As a matter of fact, I understand that you have just completed your 23rd book. Is that possible?
Yes, that's right, and I have two more on the way.
Wow!
I have a book of essays coming out in January, and then a second novel after 35 years of it coming out in June.
Wow! This is obviously what you do full time, obviously.
Well, yes, and I will say that the semi-isolation that my wife and I went through during the whole COVID crisis. Mm-hmm. I had little else to pay much attention to. I didn't have much of a social life. We didn't. And we did, after the usual precautions, see quite a bit of our grandchildren, all seven of whom, praise God, live in Vermont. Yeah. But apart from that, there was a lot of time to fill on both these projects I've described that are forthcoming were ones that had been brewing for quite a while.
Yeah.
I said, well, now is the time to you know, sort of put up or shut up. So that's how that all happened.
I got to ask you a question before we go any further, and I ask this of writers frequently, but in your case, probably more significant. When you sit down and write, is there a particular place that you go to, a particular view that goes on, or is it all in your head and you can write anywhere?
Well, I think I can write anywhere, but historically, this little camp has been a really good place for me. It's remote lake. We're usually the only people on it. There are only three other buildings on the lake. There are no motors allowed and no public launch. So it's a quiet and peaceful place to work. And then at home, the property that we built a house on had a little hunter's cabin on it, which had been winterized before we got there. And we spent the first 6 months in that little building, my wife and I and four kids. It was kind of cramped, I will say, before the house was finished.
Wow.
But that's my go-to place at home.
Wow. What is the percentage of writings that you do leaning toward poetry?
I've published 16 collections of poetry, and the nearest contender, I think, is five books of personal essays. It will soon be six.
Yeah.
And then I've only published one novel, a smattering of short stories in magazines. Yeah. But I'm principally a poet, yes.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Poetry at a time was like the thing. And then over the years, it turned out to be something that people just kind of shy away from because it's just so rhymey-shmimey. But people don't realize that every song that they hear, even rap music, that's based on poetry too. So,
I think people will have their poetry. And I was interested that, apparently during and I know this anecdotally from friends of mine, dear friends of mine who run independent bookstores. During the whole COVID experience, for some reason, there was a great spike in the sale of poetry.
Yeah.
I think it's even less the rhymey shmimey part of it that turns people off. But a lot of my friends say, "Well, you know, people don't read poetry, and it's because of capitalism or commercialism or Amazon or whatever it may be," and they never turn the light on themselves. And I've been doing this for half a century. And I look at some of the big time magazines and the poems that they publish, and I can't make head nor tail of them. I said, can anybody be moved by this? I mean, I can't even sort it out. Yeah. And life's too short at 80 to spend a lot of time sorting it out. So, yeah.
Well, certain things shouldn't be sorted out. I think they are what they are, and it's like telling a joke. If you have to explain why it's funny, we're not even in the ballgame anymore.
But I think I'm talking about poems that seem to me be willfully cryptic.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I see.
Rather than inviting the reader in,
I gotcha.
Kind of closing him or her out. I mean, I think the two forks in contemporary poetry might be embodied on the one hand by Robert Frost. Yeah. Whose poems are available to everybody. Not that they're in the least bit exhaustible, but a first grader can get something out of them, so can the grad student.
Yeah, I mean...
Ezra Pound, where you need a Oxford English Dictionary and a French Dictionary and a Chinese Dictionary and some familiarity with the Vedic sutras and that sort of thing. Yeah. And I realized that I was quite fascinated by Pound in grad school, because it was like undoing a or putting together a puzzle. And then there just came a point in my life, and I said, you know, life's too short for this sort of thing. I'm not going
to mess
around and try and decode this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, decoding it, for me, it's, you know, when I hear a song that I like and I don't like Bob Dylan, I mean, I can't understand what the hell he's saying. But then when I look at the words printed out, then it's like, oh, this is genius stuff.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how much great poetry there is in songs. You just can't understand what they're saying.
Oh, it's absolutely true. There's a lot of, there's a country song by Randy Travis, and I've always thought that this was a perfect evocation of a certain demographic in northern New England, as well as in his south, where he says there's a dirty piece of cardboard strapped across the window of my old Ford. Yeah. And he said, an empty box of chicken wings, now I'm botching it, but at any rate, and I'm dialing across the radio for a song that I can sing. That's a dirty piece of cardboard strapped across the window of my own Ford, an empty box of chicken wings, and a glass of, I know this by heart, and I'm just having sage fright.
That's right.
I've always thought, gosh, you know, this guy in three lines has kind of picked up the gist of a hard scrabble country life.
Sydney, let me ask you something. Have you ever thought of taking your poetry and then having somebody put it to music? I mean, have you ever gone in that direction?
Well, I have several times, in fact. Originally, and I'm not talking about popular music so much as more long-haired kind of thing, but the young composer in Philadelphia who contacted me out of the blue and said he wanted to put some of my poetry to music, and he selected a sequence of poems I published two books ago, He composed music for it and used the poetry as a libretto, and it was premiered up in Vermont and did very well, and people liked it, and I gather he's finally going to find a record spot for it, but I can't give you the details yet. And then he and I, and a genius man named James Kochalka, who was Vermont's first cartoonist laureate. I think we're the only state left that has a cartoonist laureate.
Probably.
And Alison Bechdel was the most recent one. And we did a kind of a three art collaboration in which James gave me a whole bunch of strange pictures, apparently unrelated. I was taxed with putting together some poetry that would somehow make all those images cohere.
Sounds like
it's
fun.
It's kind of the opposite from the usual thing, where you write music and then he does the illustration.
Wow, interesting.
And then this same fellow, Joseph Holman from Philadelphia, made put music to the whole thing. So that was
pretty cool. Well, let's talk about your most recent writing, and this has to do with aging and generational reflections. And it's very interesting because, I mean, if, you know, no matter what stage in life you are, we've all got the same stages. We all have that in common. So this is fascinating. Has this just been released recently?
It's not even officially published yet. Although it's
we'll get it. We'll get it.
This is now, I think.
We'll get it.
It's September 15th, but it's available from the Great Devil, Amazon, and other places, the wonderful publisher, New York publisher, called Four Way Books. All they do is poetry, and they're just a wonderful press.
Good.
And, I prefer people to order direct from them, and you can Google their site at any point.
Well, anyway, they can get it. Yeah, it's called What Shines, and it's great. I mean, everybody can connect with it. The point is. And it's done in a way in the way that you do things, Sydney.
Well, I guess so. The older I get, I guess the more I am myself. But
oh, really? I have a feeling you always were. But okay.
Well, yeah, but to some extent.
All right.
Although that big figure 80 doesn't panic me, but it makes clear that, you know, the footsteps are approaching.
Yeah, yeah.
So it led to even more reminiscent modes than I'm known for. And what I found interesting, you know, I didn't say, I'm going to sit down and write this book about so-and-so. I wrote a bunch of poems, and then I said, well, I think I have a book. Let's see how they fit together. But the notion was I would go back to various stages in my life, reflect on them, and kind of compare my sense of what they were all about as I see it now to the way I saw it then, ever mindful of the fact that my mind at both phases could have been playing tricks on myself.
Yeah,
you know, tell each other. We tell ourselves stories to make sense of the world, and sometimes they're accurate, and sometimes they're almost at a whole cost.
It's all perception. Yeah, it is. It's a great writing, and we're looking forward to it, to be honest with you. And please keep doing what you're doing, because
as long as I'm taking nourishment, it looks like that's what I'm gonna do. I'll say very quickly, speaking of COVID, the last section of the book called Animate Objects is kind of a directly occasioned by COVID, because we were sort of semi-quarantined, and I was looking for stuff to write about. I didn't have much of a social life, so I started looking for objects around the house, some of them fairly commonplace, like an old carved duck decoy that my grandfather-in-law left to my wife, an old grandfather clock made by my Pennsylvania Dutch great-great-grandfather, a model boat, things of that nature, and just kind of, it was very unlike me. I'm not a very zen kind of a guy, but I would sit there and just contemplate them for quite a while. Uh-huh. And then I would start writing about them, not really knowing where it was going to go. But that's how that got generated.
It works. Whatever it is, it works.
I'm really glad you think so. That's
true. Yeah. Sydney Lee is his name. Sydney, in case you need the spelling, Lea. And it's What Shines. You can Google both of those. I guess that's the only thing Google is good for. there you have it. Hey, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Maybe we'll hook up again at the next writing. Shall we do that?
Well, I hope so, Ron. It's been a delight to talk to you.
Great. You take care, Sydney. Thank you so much. Well, that'll do it for me today. Hey. I'll be back again on Monday with a brand new program. I hope you join me then. My hopes are very high. But until that time arrives, have a wonderful weekend. Until then, I wish you peace.